Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Today, we will be reading the following articles: Railway Post Office, Scenic Hints for Appalachian Layouts, and Putting the Track in T-Track. The first article is Railway Post Office, conducted by Eric White. Where are the small layouts? In your October issue, Eric Solhell from Oslo, Norway, wrote regarding the status of our hobby. His opinion is that fewer people are enjoying the hobby today than 30 or 40 years ago. If this is true, I believe that part of that fault lays with us. If someone is interested in starting out in our hobby and picks up one of the few magazines devoted to model railroading, it can be very intimidating. In just the October issue of Model Railroader alone, you will find articles that refer to a 3D printer's DCC, a quote-unquote small layout that fills a room that's 9 by 11 feet, and a club layout. To a newcomer, this has to be very intimidating, plus the cost of some of these items can be prohibitive to a younger person. I model an N scale and work on my 6th layout that is currently only 27 square feet. See photos above. I do not have a spray booth, everything is hand-painted, and the only power tool I use is a drill. I have to be very aware of the environment, since everything is located in a living space, parentheses, and I do get the comment from my wife every once in a while that whatever I'm doing stinks, close parentheses. I do read every issue from front to back, because even at my age of 73, there is always something to learn. However, I believe a truly beginner's column that at one point the magazine had would be very useful in introducing a newcomer to the hobby and maybe getting either he or she to start a truly small layout. Signed, John O'Connor, Oceanside, New York. Don't hide your trains. Read Eric Solhell's letter, quote, Keeping the Hobby Alive, end quote, Model Railroader, October 2024. Very true. My three layouts are all shelf layouts in different rooms in my apartment. When we have guests, they and their kids especially, are fascinated. I let the kids run the trains while the adults are talking, but the adults want to run the trains too. The next thing I hear from them is that they bought a small starter set and that dad and son are busy playing together on the floor. So, instead of building a layout in the basement or a spare room, build a point-to-point shelf layout, parentheses, using reversing machines, close parentheses, in your living room. This way, you get to enjoy your model railroad, even when it is not in operation, since you can always enjoy the view. And when guests come over, let them run some trains. Signed, Dwayne Phillips, Berlin. Club offers skills clinics. I recently read the article on keeping the hobby alive, and I totally agree we must continue to pass on the hobby to the next generation. I'm the president of the Belmont Shore Railroad Club here in San Pedro, California. As of my first year as president, I began programs by offering free clinics on airbrushing, soldering, weathering, and all aspects of not just model railroading, but model building. I even began an outreach, taking to the streets and going to youth groups in churches, schools, and scouts. Yes, we need to pass this fantastic hobby to the new generation, and doing efforts such as these will help to pass it on. Signed, Jesse Munoz. Get the big guys involved. Quote, keeping the hobby alive, end quote, caught my attention. You know, Eric Solhell makes a good point. If we don't get our young audience engaged in model railroading, we're going to lose them to the vast and overwhelming stuff they see online. I would take what Eric said one step further. maybe now is the time to draw the real-life, full-size railway manufacturers and railroads into this. Imagine Union Pacific, or BNSF, sponsoring some hands-on rail shows where our youth can make a connection between full-scale and taking that into model railroad construction. After all, model railroading is a copied, small-scale version of the real thing. I'd think when the full-sized railroads get involved, it's good PR for them and gives model railroading a much-needed booster shot. Sometimes what seems far-fetched can fetch what's seemingly far away. Sometimes. Signed, Steve Gorsline, Colony, Kansas. Eric Solhel's letter sparked many replies, more than we could print here. We agree more model railroaders is a good thing. However, the topic of youth in the hobby is an old one. While the hobby is changing, there aren't any significant signs of it going away. Signed, Eric White, editor. The next article is Step by Step by Douglas Kirkpatrick. Install a Sugar Cube Speaker. In the June 2016 installment of DCC Corner, contributing editor Larry Puckett presented an excellent article on installing a WOW sound decoder in an Atlas HO Scale RS3. The Train Control Systems, TCS, kit includes all necessary parts to replace existing hardware with a new decoder and speaker system. Following Larry's detailed instructions, I was able to have several of my RS3s humming down the tracks in no time. As with many things in life, there are always trade-offs. The TCS speaker and enclosure is a white plastic unit that fits in place of the metal weight. Removing the weight does affect the pulling power of the locomotive. For local freight or yard assignments, the sound system didn't impact operations. However, out on the main line with grades, I was limited in the number of cars a single locomotive could pull. A fellow modeler showed me a sugar cube speaker that contained a built-in baffling system in a remarkably small space. Doug Kirkpatrick, a frequent contributor to Model Railroad and its special issues, lives in Falls Church, Virginia. Step 1. The Sugar Cube. I was able to locate a sugar cube speaker with an 11 by 30 millimeter footprint that's 6 millimeters deep. This will fill the need of having sound without the loss of pulling capability. I placed the sugar cube speaker on top of the metal weight and marked where I needed to remove material. Not having a milling machine, I approached the task using only a hacksaw and flat file. I turned the weight on end and, using the hacksaw, sliced down through it the depth of the speaker until I came to the notch where the wires are run from the truck. It became apparent that the metal weight was not lead, but a very hard cast metal. Using a new hacksaw blade made the job a lot easier. When cutting a weight like this, you want to make sure that you make your cuts with sufficient space for the speaker. Filing should only be done to clean up the edges after you're finished sawing. Step 2. Cleanup. I used a large, flat file to clean up the saw cut. Then I trimmed the pieces of metal I cut off in the previous step until they seated neatly alongside the speaker. Every bit of metal helps. The result is a pocket the exact size of the speaker. I used a toothbrush and vacuum cleaner to remove all chips and filings from the weight. I applied a small dab of Walther's goo to hold the speaker in place, then glued the two side pieces in place. There's a small tab on each side of the speaker to solder wires from the decoder. The new speaker requires that the master volume CV be set to about half of full volume before power is applied. The sound level can then be adjusted from this level without risking damage to the speaker. I removed approximately a 16th of an inch from the end of the baffle to accommodate the front headlight bulb. I used scrap styrene to reseal the baffle. Step 3. More pulling power. I took a single RS3 to my local club layout, which has a 3.75% serpentine grade that challenges many locomotives. I compared the engine's pulling power with the kit speaker enclosure and with the updated speaker to determine if the result was indeed worth the effort. After making several test runs with 40-foot freight cars and a caboose, I was able to pull 10 freight cars versus 7 freight cars up the grade, representing a 30% improvement over the kit installation. The next article is Scenic Hints for Appalachian Layouts. Use Geology to Enhance Your Model Railroad. By Herm Botswow. Photos by Mark Corliss. When our northeastern railroads built westward, they had to overcome both construction and operational challenges to cross the Appalachian Mountains. From north to south, these challenges were resolved by constructing steep, twisting climbs at many places, including New Hampshire's Crawford Notch, Pennsylvania's Horseshoe Curve, and the former Baltimore and Ohio Railroad's quote-unquote sand patch. Modeling the Appalachian Mountains is a great way to add interest to your layout and provide a wide range of operational opportunities. The first that come to mind are the challenges posed by formidable grades and sharp curves. These are the result of a geology that lends itself to modeling, steep, narrow valleys. Railroads often shared these with a twisting highway, narrow, winding streams with rapids and small dams, dense, uniform, deciduous forests, and tiny villages whose single line of roadside buildings sat against the hillsides. With a narrow valley floor, space is at a premium. In the photo above, two railroads, my Buckeye Railroad and the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, are competing for the same space. Here, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad is on the upper level, as it was the first to ascend the valley. Constructed later, the Buckeye Railroad is closest to the aisle. Note the water courses along the table edges, the two villages tucked against the hillside on each side of the valley, and the difference in track elevation between the right and left side of the photo as the right-of-ways climb to a mountain pass. In the photo, the Buckeye Railroad climbs from 45 inches above the floor to 49 inches. The B&O climbs from 45 inches to 51 inches. Both lines originate and terminate their trips elsewhere on the layout in terminals that are at an elevation of 41 inches. The flat area at the front of your table is a good place to put a river if you are modeling this region. Dropping the flat area down several inches, adding an embankment, and pouring resin are easy enhancements that show your railroad, like the real ones, follows a water course to reduce gradients. The following are more ideas for using the geology of the Appalachian Mountains to enhance your model railroad. Herm Botzow and his wife, Judy Hildebrandt, live in southeastern New Hampshire. Herm's O-scale Buckeye Railroad layout was featured in the April 2014 issue of Model Railroader. Parallel main lines and a dam. Creating differences between the two railroads shown in the first photograph adds interest and authenticity. The two tracks for the two railroads are at different elevations, are not exactly parallel, and feature different size rails and different colored ballast. The lower track for the Buckeye Railroad serves two villages, while the B&O tracks bypass the villages, further suggesting that they are at different lines. Add a dam to the stream along the front of your table. Create a pool behind the dam, and then have the river narrow even more as the tracks follow the river upstream. Another idea, utilize embankments while avoiding a flat valley. Inevitably, small watercourses will descend from the mountainsides and, because of erosion, create gullies and an irregular shoreline. The larger of these depressions can be utilized for an industry, such as the enclosed coal trestle in Picture 1. The trestle is modeled after a similar facility in Sayre, Pennsylvania. One misconception is that the valley floor continually slopes upward from a watercourse to the base of a mountain. In older mountains, the valley first fills with sedimentary deposits until it is nearly level. Then, the watercourse starts to erode the banks, making a trough for itself and, as it steals adjoining soil, creating a cross-section that becomes slightly rounded as it descends gently toward the watercourse. One way this can be simulated is by appropriately varying the height of the risers under your benchwork, screwing thin plywood over the top of them, and covering that plywood with a field. The next idea, add a pusher siding and narrow the valley. To increase the drama on your layout, consider locating a pusher siding at the base of a grade. You do not have to actually model pusher service. Instead, show an abandoned siding, suggesting that your railroad's motive power has been upgraded throughout the years. The single-track main line shown in the photo above works best when simulating a narrow valley. As your trains reach the top of the grade, the valley will narrow and the adjoining hills steepen. Narrow the stream that your track is following and, as the railroad approaches the height of the land that you have created, model the source of the stream, perhaps as a mill pond with an adjacent trackside industry commonly found in the region. Consider including a water tank if you are modeling the stream era. The next idea, deep cuts at the layout edge. At the crest of a grade, railroads often cut through a mountain to begin their descent into the adjoining valley. Consider placing this effect at a corner of your layout table. In this instance, as mentioned previously, the Baltimore and Ohio was the first to use the cut. The Buckeye Railroad came later, widening and deepening the cut to ease its gradient. Separating the layout with this feature can add to the perceived length of the main line. Editor's note, adding cuts to the layout edge also adds easily accessible drama to any layout photography. End of the note. Modeled in O-scale, the right side of the cut extends 40 inches from the corner of the table to the spot where the scenery on the right side descends to track level. In HO, this would be approximately 20 inches. The next tip, disappearing roads and forced perspective. As the two railroads descend into the next valley, they cross a rural highway. After crossing the B&O track, the highway climbs towards the next ridgeline and crosses into the next adjoining valley. This is possible to suggest in a minimum space if the road is shown disappearing behind a rock outcropping. Suggesting an adjacent valley adds depth and interest to the scene. Finally, a forced perspective is used to simulate an extended valley in another location on the layout. To add depth, the foreground includes an O-scale model of a former feed mill in South New Berlin, New York. The middle area shows an HO-scale farm, and the distant area, an N-scale farm. The progression for HO modelers could be from HO to double T and finally N. The next article is putting the track in T-track. Part 2, benchwork, track, and wiring for our N-scale Colorado Plains T-track layout. By Bryson Sleppy, photos by David Popp. As I mentioned last month, even though we're building Colorado Plains to be its own layout with consistent scenery, we still want to be able to use our modules in other T-track layouts, so we had to adhere to standards. These standards focus heavily on benchwork, track placement, and wiring, which is the focus of this month's installment in our project layout series. We followed standards and recommended practices for T-track set in place by the North American T-Track Organization that can be found online at ntrak.org. While the Model Railroader staff had a lot of fun building our HO-scale Fremo layout in 2024, parentheses, that can be found in the January through April 2024 issues, close parentheses, I was excited to hear that all of the benchwork we needed for T-Track could be purchased as laser-cut kits. This meant we could speed through the benchwork phase and get to the fun of laying track and placing scenery, right? Though we planned to eventually weather and ballast our track, we appreciated that unlike Fremo, T-Track standards don't specify aesthetic features like ballast color or track weathering color. So all we had to do was ensure that each module was built properly with the correct dimensions, our track was laid according to the standard, and our wiring was completed in a way that was compatible with other modules. The first section is benchwork. David started this project for his new book, Your Guide to N-Scale Railroading, by purchasing a corner, two straights, and a bridge module from RS Laser Kits. After I joined in the fun, we ordered six more kits to make a complete loop. When Rich from RS Laser Kits sent the modules, he included two new beta test kits as well. Instead of a flat wood top like the others, The beta modules were designed to use 1-inch and 2-inch extruded foam insulation board inserts, but still have plywood track boards. This allows sections of the foam to be cut away to make scenery below track grade. That's how David made the modules for the 2016 T-Track Challenge, see the June 2016 model railroader, allowing Kent Johnson to build a river scene. When David constructed the modules in 2016, he built them following plans on the info page at ntrak.org. Back then, he had to cut and glue wood and foam. With these module kits, most of the work was already done for us. To start, we each built a straight module. For more detailed information, use your smartphone to scan the QR code shown above to watch David's construction video on trains.com. Most of the components for a single module are shown in Figure 1 on the next page. The parts are laser-cut wood and require only minimal cleanup with sandpaper, as well as punching out some of the slots. We started the project by building the corner braces. Each brace is made by gluing a triangle with tabs to a triangle without tabs. Use yellow carpenter's glue for this and be sure the holes match up. We used damps to keep the plywood from warping. Be sure the holes are aligned. The feet need to be aligned to work properly. The back of the straight section needs to have reinforcement blocks glued to the inside face. These are required if you wish to add skyboards, or backdrops, to your module. Be sure the block clears the corner brace slots below it. Taking one module side and one end section, we applied glue to the interlocking corner tabs, as well as to the tabs on one corner brace. Then we plugged all three parts into position. Note how the corner tab clears the reinforcing blocks on the back panel. We did the same for the second half, then let both module halves dry for about an hour. Next, we connected the two halves of the box and glued the corner braces in place. At the same time, we glued the center brace into the box. While the glue for the box frame was still curing, we installed the two top boards, being sure to apply glue to all tabs on both parts. With the top in place, we used blue painter's tape to keep the parts locked tightly together and square. The technique worked better than clamps, which can deform the thin plywood parts. After we finished each module, we set a heavy book on it to keep the top from warping, see Figure 4 opposite. We left the books and tape on the modules overnight to make sure the glue was completely dry. The next day, David sanded the tops of the modules so that the edges where the frame tabs connected were flush. This was an important step as it allowed the track to lay flat. The kits include brass threaded nuts. One goes in the hole of each corner brace. Ensure the nut goes into the hole straight. Overall, these module kits were pretty easy to build. For non-standard modules like the one with a foam top, some modifications were needed. The tops of the reinforcing blocks had to be trimmed to fit around the slot for the depressed wood top, see Figure 5. Since the wood top is recessed into the module frame, bar clamps were used to hold the pieces while the glue set up, see Figure 6. Once the glue dried, 1-inch foam board sections were cut to fit inside the box. For the 2-inch box, it was easier to use layers of 1-inch foam than try to work with a full 2-inch block, see Figure 7. The double module that I built proved to be a little more challenging than the single. Before assembling the frame, I had to glue the front and backs together from multiple parts that connected with reinforcement plates. Also, the top came as three separate pieces, not two like the single. It turns out that the double is also 1-inch shallower than the other singles. I initially considered leaving it that way, but David figured out we could cut a 1x2 down to 1-inch wide and glue it to the back of the module, see Figure 8. This way, all modules were the same depth. When we added the backdrops, they all lined up. The rest of this article will be continued next week. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader Magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to The Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com. In collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at aftersight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.